Afternoon to everybody. Nice to see you all here. We didn't come last week. I was a little bit not under the weather, but really, really, really sore from shoveling snow. I have to remember I'm not as young as I used to be, but I guess nobody is, right? I enjoyed some of those songs there that we don't sing too often. I think one or two of them I don't think we've ever sung before, but it's always a challenge to get a new song ready. And while we were singing them, I was thinking in my mind, I listen on my way to work in the morning to a station out of Philadelphia that plays classical music. And I listen because at 7:15 every morning they play a march. And that's really rousing in the morning. He calls it his Seuss Alarm Club. And you can become a member of it by requesting a song. But I often think, when songs were first new, some of the songs that you listen to a classic station like that, and some of the songs I listened to, and I thought, well, I never heard that before. But then one that I have heard before, instantaneously, I know it. Not maybe the title, but I know the tune, and I can hum along with it. And I've often wondered to myself, the first time, for example, Tchaikovsky ever performed the 1812 Overture, were the people in the audience overwhelmed? I mean, did they realize that they were in the presence of greatness at that point in time? Or was it Rossini that wrote the William Tell Overture, I believe? When those trumpets went, bam, da-da-da, did the audience say, wow, this is something? Or did they just listen to it and say, wow, just another symphony? I don't know. I would love to, maybe in the resurrection, talk to some people like that that witnessed the very first performance of something great and see what they thought, what their private thoughts were. Anyway, those are my private thoughts. Not any private anymore. I'm going to describe somebody for this sermon here. I'll give you a description of this man, and in your mind, see if you can think who I'm talking about. And when I get this description done, I'll ask for your thoughts as to who this man was. Now, this man rose to power. I say rose. It was in the past. He's dead now. But this man rose to power in the Middle East, in a country in the Middle East. When he became known, he was actually initially under the authority of another man. But he came to replace that man and became the one in power himself over the entire nation. When he was in power over that nation, he united many of the civilian entities of the nation. He united the military, became a strong force in the country he lived in. He killed, or had killed by his men, hundreds if not thousands of people. He was a man with blood on his hands, in other words. He had four wives. He had a bunch of children. In his day, he was known far and wide. He was known far beyond his own country. Who do you think this was? Anybody? King David? Actually, you're getting ahead of me. I'm talking about Saddam Hussein. I will get to David, though. You notice the similarities between those two men. Now, for example, David, he rose to power in a Middle East country, did he not? And David was initially under the authority of another man, King Saul. And David, when he came to the supreme power in the country, united many of the civilian entities of that nation of Israel, as well as the military. He had a strong, powerful military under David's control. David killed, or had killed, hundreds, thousands. Tells us in 1 Samuel 18:7 that the women celebrating his slaughter of the Philistines were playing musical instruments and singing, Saul has slain his thousands, David his ten thousands. So David was a man of blood. He had blood on his hands. David, like Saddam Hussein, had four wives. And David had a bunch of children. David actually had a lot more children than Saddam Hussein did. So he was a little bit more prolific that way. But in his day, David's name was known far and wide. He was a very well-known figure throughout much of the known world at the time. He was a very well-known name. Now, you saw the similarities, and actually this sermon is not going to be about Saddam Hussein, so don't get your hopes up. It's going to be about David, and it's actually the first of three sermons I'm going to give about aspects of David, about aspects of his life. So this will be like the introductory sermon, and then the next two to follow will cover various aspects. But Saddam Hussein was hanged. You probably remember this. It wasn't too long ago. It was in 2006, December of that year. He was convicted of crimes against humanity, as many dictators have been convicted, and he was hanged by his own people. On the other hand, David was pronounced by the Lord as a man after his own heart. And David will be promoted in the future. Yeah, that's a little bit strange, isn't it? The fact that there's so much of a similarity between Saddam Hussein and David, but David would be promoted. Now, turn over to Jeremiah, the 30th chapter, and we'll read about this promotion that David's going to have in the future. Jeremiah 30, and beginning in verse 9. Alas, that day is great, so that none is like it. We're talking about, of course, the day of the Lord to come sometime in the future. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. For it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord of hosts, that I will break his yoke from off your neck and will burst your bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of him. But they shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them. So David's going to be resurrected at that time after Christ returns, or at his coming, and he's going to serve as a king. He's going to be promoted to not only just a king over physical Israel, but he's going to be a king over nations on the earth, present-day earth. If you'll notice in Ezekiel, turn to another prophet here, Ezekiel 34. There's some other details added to it. Ezekiel 34, and beginning in verse 22, he says, "Therefore I will save my flock, and they shall no more be a prey. I will judge between cattle and cattle." Of course, the Lord talking here. "I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David." Here he's called a shepherd, which, play on what David's initial occupation was of being a shepherd, but now he's going to be a shepherd over men. "He shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken it." So this is, his way of saying, the Lord's way of saying, it will come to pass because I said it. If we go over to Ezekiel 37, just a page or two turned, Ezekiel 37 and verse 21, "Say unto them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, where they be gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two nations any more at all." There will not be an Israel and a Judah, but one. "Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions, but I will save them out of all their dwelling places, wherein they have sinned, and will cleanse them. So shall they be my people, and I will be their God. And David, my servant, shall be king over them. And they all shall have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments, and observe my statutes, and do them. And they shall dwell in the land that I have given unto Jacob, my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt. And they will dwell therein, even they and their children and their children's children, forever. And my servant David shall be their prince forever." So that's a long-term thing that David, who is now resting in his grave, has to look forward to. Let's look at one more scripture, a prophecy over in Hosea, right after Daniel. Hosea 3 and verses 4 and 5. "For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king and without a prince and without a sacrifice and without an image, without an ephod and without teraphim. Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days." So if we think about the prophecies talking about people coming to seek the Lord, you know, on God's mountain. But it says here they're going to come to seek David also, their king. So he has an important function awaiting him. This man, who in many ways resembled Saddam Hussein when he was alive. Well, what about that statement that was made by the people that he has killed his tens of thousands? How can you justify that? Let's look at Acts 13 once. Acts 13, and we're going to break into a sermon or a speech, whatever you would want to call it, that Paul is giving here. He was with Barnabas, and they had a company of people, and they were traveling, and Paul had the opportunity to speak. And he speaks starting at verse 14 here in chapter 13. And he's talking about the history of Israel leading up to the time of David. It starts in verse 14 by saying, "But when they departed from Perga, they came to Antioch in Pisidia, and they went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. After the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them and said, 'You men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say it.' And so Paul stood up, he beckoned with his hand and said, 'Men of Israel and you that fear God, give audience.'" In other words, listen to what I'm about to say. "The God of this people of Israel chose our fathers and exalted the people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. And with a high arm brought he them out of it." That time that we're going to be thinking about on the night to be much observed that we have coming up. "About the time of 40 years, he suffered their manners in the wilderness. And when he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he divided their land to them by lot. And after that, he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. And afterward, they desired a king. And God gave unto them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. Now, in verse 22, when he had removed him, he raised up unto them David to be their king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, 'I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, which shall fulfill all my will.'" So the Lord himself said that. He's a man after my own heart. "Of this man's seed, of David's seed, has God, according to his promise, raised up unto Israel a Savior, Jesus." So here we see this man who was declared to be after God's own heart would be a great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather of our Savior, Jesus Christ, in the flesh. Now, if we look back at 1 Samuel chapter 13, we see where this statement came from that Paul made. 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14 says, "But now your kingdom shall not continue," the Lord talking to Saul. "The Lord has sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be captain over this people, because you have not kept that which the Lord commanded you." So this was an indictment of Saul, and the Lord was telling Saul, there's going to be coming somebody who is a man after my own heart. Now, the implication is there, God wanted Saul to be after his own heart too, didn't he? But he found David. So how do we rectify that after all that we see that David did in his life? How could he be called a man after God's own heart? Well, what I'm going to do in this sermon is we're going to take a look, first of all, at how physically Jesus was descended from David. Let's review some of the genealogies to kind of get in our mind the chronology of where these men came from. Then I'm going to take a look at just a couple of David's sins that he committed that are well written down for it, well documented, sins and killings. And then we'll see how, in the light of all of these things, David could be called a man after God's own heart. Now, if we turn back to Genesis 36 for the beginning of the genealogy search here, Genesis 38. And I'm going to read the first 12 verses here in Genesis 38. This starts with a man by the name of Judah. You remember Judah was one of the sons of Israel. And it's a famous thing that happened during the life of Judah. It's to his shame. But I won't read the whole thing, but let's just get familiar with what happened with Judah. "It came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in unto her. Now, first of all, depending on what translation you're reading, it might not be as confusing as the King James that I'm reading here. When you first read that in the King James, it almost sounds like the woman that Judah hooked up with was named Shua. But that's not, it's kind of a poor translation in the King James. It said, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. Well, whose name was Shua was the Canaanite. So the daughter of Shua was the one that Judah actually saw. And he took her, the daughter of Shua. Now you'll notice in this whole section here, the daughter of Shua is never named by her name. So anytime she is identified, it says the daughter of Shua. Well, she conceived and she bore a son, and he called his name Ur. Okay, so Judah now has a son. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she yet again conceived and bore a son and called his name Shelah. And he was at Chezeb when she bare him. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. Now Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. So now Tamar is a widow. Now Judah said unto Onan, his next son, you go, take your brother's wife, marry her, and raise up seed to your brother. You know, that was a custom back in those days, because the first son had no children for his inheritance rights. And so in verse 9, Onan knew that the seed would not be his own, it wouldn't be his child. And it came to pass that when he had sex with his brother's wife, which was now his wife, he decided to do a little bit of chicanery. You know, he just practiced birth control, is what they're actually saying here, which he was not supposed to be doing. He was supposed to be raising up a child for his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. Starting to see a little bit of blood on the Lord's hands here too, right? There's two brothers that he's killed. Then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at your father's house until Shelah, my son, be grown, the third son now. For he said, lest peradventure he die also, as his brethren did. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. And in process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted. And so his wife was now dead. He went up to his sheep shearers to Timnath, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. Now, we'll fast forward over to verse 27. What happened, we know, is the incident where Judah actually saw what he thought to be a prostitute, which was actually his daughter-in-law, Tamar. But the reason why she had dressed up like that was because she was cheated. Judah actually gave his third son to somebody else. And so she actually dressed up like a prostitute. Judah had relations with her, and she became pregnant. And in verse 27, it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, there were twins in her womb. And it came to pass when she travailed that the one who put out his hand, the midwife took and bound on his hand a scarlet thread and said, this one came out first, as a way to identify who was born first of the twins. And it came to pass as he drew back his hand, the child did, that behold, his brother actually was born first. And she said, how is it that you have broken forth first? This breach be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Phares. So Phares apparently is a name that meant some kind of a breach. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. But you see here that Phares was the one who was born first. That that name Phares, excuse me, Phares and Zerah were twin sons of Judah. So just remember that. Okay, now let's fast forward to the book of Ruth, and we'll continue the story of the genealogy. Ruth right after Judges. And Ruth, of course, a quick summary of the story. We know that this is a story of Naomi, who was married to a man by the name of Abimelech. They were from Israel, but they had moved to the country of Moab. And in Moab, Naomi's husband died, and her two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, married two Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth, and that's how Ruth comes into the story. The Ephrathites or the Bethlehem Judahites, were the people who lived in the area around Bethlehem, and that's where Naomi and Elimelech were originally from. So she was an Israelite, whereas her two daughters-in-law and her two sons had married were actually Moabites. Well, her two sons died, so now she had just two daughters-in-law. And you know the story about how Orpah was content to leave and go back away from her mother-in-law, but Ruth wasn't. Ruth stayed with Naomi. And if we turn to Ruth 4, we see the genealogy involved here. Part of the story, the end of the story, was that a man by the name of Boaz, who was a near kinsman, decided he would exercise what Onan refused to do in the case of his brother dying. Boaz was going to redeem the fact that he was a kinsman and take it upon himself to marry Ruth. And in the process, he would raise up a son to Ruth's first husband. And so there was a long ceremony involved here, and Boaz finally did agree, and all the people that were witnesses said, yes, this is according to our traditions, and Boaz agreed to become married to Ruth. So if we pick up the story here in verse 9 of Ruth 4, Boaz said to the elders and unto all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, I have purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead shall not be cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses this day. All the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses, and the Lord make the woman that has come unto your house like Rachel and like Leah, which too did build the house of Israel, and you do worthily in Ephratah, and be famous in Bethlehem. And let your house be like the house of Phares. Remember, we just read about Phares, where he came from, back in Genesis. So the people were well pleased with what Boaz is doing, and they're pronouncing blessings upon him and his posterity. Let your house be like the house of Phares, whom Tamar bare unto Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give you of this young woman. And so Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And the women said unto Naomi, blessed be the Lord, which has not left you this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And so not only was Ruth's husband benefiting from this with a descendant, but also Naomi was. This would be her grandchild. He shall be unto you a restorer of your life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, which loves you, which is better to you than seven sons, has borne him. Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom and became a nurse to it. And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. Obed, my margin says, means worshiper. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David, which the margin says David means beloved. So there were good names given here, names of importance for the future. And so we see that it summarizes the generations now in verse 18. Now here are the generations of Phares from back in Genesis. Phares begot Hezron, then Ram, Amminadab, Nashon. Nashon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz. Boaz Obed, and Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. So now we have the genealogy all the way from Judah and his son Phares all the way down to David. You can see all the names involved there. Now, if we turn to Matthew 1, we're going to continue on the genealogy. As I said, I want to trace it not only to David, but also from David to Jesus. We'll see that this man that the Lord declared to be a man after his own heart was actually, when the Lord became a human being, was actually one of his great-great ancestors. So let's read the genealogy here in Matthew 1 and verse 3. This genealogy starts with Abraham in verse 2. It's going to go from Abraham down toward the present. By verse 3, it tells us that Judah, that we read back in Genesis, begat Phares and Zerah of Tamar. Okay, this is that same line. In verse 6, Jesse begat David, the king. And David the king begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. And so in these few verses here, you go from Judah, Pharisees, down to David. Now let's continue over in verse 16. This is a continuing name-by-name genealogy. Pharisees to David. And now Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called the Christ. Now you'll notice here that, first of all, this is a genealogy, actually, of Joseph, who married Mary. It says Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary. Jacob was Joseph's father. And so the genealogy we're following here is the genealogy down to Joseph. You notice it went through from Pharisees to David to Joseph. And it doesn't say begat as far as Joseph begat Jesus. It just says the husband of Mary of whom was born Jesus. Of course, the father was God. So that's a genealogy down to Jesus that goes through Joseph. Okay, let's turn over to Luke now for the second genealogy that we're given. And this genealogy is going to go through Mary. Why have two genealogies? Well, the first genealogy of Matthew shows the royal line through the father. In this case, it would have been the stepfather, Joseph. The genealogy in Luke shows the actual physical births. And in Luke 3, and beginning in verse 23, it says, Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph. It says, who was the son of Heli, who was the son of Matt. And now this generation, this genealogy is going backwards. Remember, the other one went from Abraham to the future. This was starting with Jesus and going back in time. But what about this first statement here in verse 23. It says, Jesus himself was the son of Joseph, which was the son of Heli. Well, Jesus, of course, was not the son of Joseph. He was the son of God. But it's telling us that Joseph was the son of Heli. Well, in the other genealogy, it said his father's name was Jacob. Well, what this actually is telling us is that Joseph was the son-in-law of Heli. Heli would have been the father of Mary. Now, this is not unusual to word it this way. In fact, the King James translators, when they translated this Greek, wrote son of Joseph, which was the son in italics of Heli. The son was not in the original Greek. So basically, the original Greek said the son of Joseph, which was of Heli. Now, how was Joseph of Heli? Heli was Joseph's father-in-law. Well, it is correctly translated because Joseph would have been called Heli's son. Not that he was his actual born son, but he would have been, in those days, referred to as Heli's son. Today, we use the term son-in-law. It's just that different. So it looks strange to us when we look at it, but it actually meant at the time that Joseph was Heli's son-in-law. And that was commonplace, I guess you would say, in Israel. If you go back to 1 Samuel again, you see an example of this. In 1 Samuel 24, there's a statement here, just a brief little verse. 1 Samuel 24 and verse 16. Saul was speaking to David. Now, you remember Saul gave his daughter Michal to be David's wife at one point. It says, it came to pass when David had made an end of speaking these words to Saul that Saul said, is this your voice, my son, David? See, Saul wasn't his natural father, but in the way that they spoke and considered things in those days, he could call him his son. He was actually his son-in-law. But you see now that kind of clarifies the genealogy there in Luke. So you have Joseph's genealogy, you have Mary's genealogy. Both of them show you that Jesus was a descendant of David, who was a descendant of Pharisees, a son of Judah. So you see on both sides of his family, on his maternal side and his fraternal side, Jesus was descended from the same people. The only difference being that the Matthew genealogy shows that Joseph was descended from David through Solomon. Okay? Luke genealogy shows that Mary was descended from David through Nathan. Solomon and Nathan were brothers, and they were full brothers. They had the same mother. Her name was Bathsheba. So you can see how the line culminating in Jesus came about down through the years. Now, with all of that as a background to David, he had a very important responsibility. He was going to be a descendant or an ancestor. He was an ancestor of the Savior that was going to come. Let's look at two specific incidents in the life of David that make you want to shake your head when you hear that he was considered to be a man after God's own heart. The first one we can read in 2 Samuel 11, and this is the famous story about Bathsheba, the one who we just saw was the mother of both Solomon and Nathan. And Bathsheba, this story starts in 2 Samuel 11, and I'll start with verse 1 here and read down through a little bit of it. It came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David tarried at Jerusalem. Now there's a war going on. Okay, David is at home in Jerusalem, and it came to pass in the evening that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. So apparently they had a deck or something up there that he could go up there and walk around. From the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. So David sent and inquired after the woman, and one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her. She came in, he had relations with her, and then she returned to her house. And the woman conceived and sent and told David, "I am pregnant." The only problem with the whole story was she's already married to somebody else. And I won't belabor the point, but we know the story, what David... It wasn't just that he committed adultery. Once he found out that she was married, and who she was married to, she was married to an officer, a soldier, I should say, in his army, Uriah the Hittite. Now, David was called a man after God's own heart. Now, what happened in this case? He had Uriah killed. He had Uriah killed, Uriah the Hittite. He said to his officer, "Put him in front of the next battle and let him absorb the slings and the arrows of misfortune," you might say. And he made sure that Bathsheba's husband, that's who this was killed. Well, my Bible is under chapter 11, says David's great sin. And over the next two sermons, when I talk about David, I'm going to be pointing out some other sins that he did. I don't know if this is the greatest or not, but this was a pretty bad one that's described in this whole chapter. It was a sin of the flesh. David totally ignored God's laws. He broke several there. You know, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder. He shamed the office of the king of Israel. And when you think that office of being the king of Israel is a throne that Jesus is going to take when he returns, and David laid shame to that office, how do we rectify that with him being called a man after God's own heart? Let's look at one other incident, and that goes back to 1 Samuel. And this involves a man by the name of Goliath. 1 Samuel. And we'll go to chapter 17. We all, even the kids in the congregation, know who Goliath was and the fame. You know, if Goliath was available today, how many millions of dollars would he get to sign up for the NBA? He'd be almost as high as the net and the backboard. The Bible that I have describes him as being somewhere between 8.5 to 10 feet tall, depending on how you define a cubit and a span. But he was a huge guy. In 1 Samuel 17 and verse 1, the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle, and they were gathered together at Shochoh, which belongs to Judah. And they pitched between Shochoh and Azekah in Ephes-Damon. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had on a helmet of brass, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass, which I'm not sure how many pounds that is, but I'm sure it was a lot. And it describes how foreboding this man was to the Israelites to have to look at this, because what was happening was he was the champion. He was going out and saying, "You pick one of your guys to fight me." You know, today you sometimes hear jokingly that, well, you know, the next time we go to war, why not just have the President of the United States fight against the premier of whatever country? You know, winner take all, but we don't do that today. But they did back then. And so the Philistine said in verse 10, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Okay, let's go to verse 40 now and pick up the story. David was given by Saul all kinds of armor, things to wear. David wasn't big enough and experienced enough to even wear them or use them. So he took his staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. When the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, because he was but a youth, and ruddy, and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with staves?" The Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." And then David, this little upstart David, says to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day will the Lord deliver you into my hand. And I will smite you and take your head from you, and I will give your carcass to the host of the Philistines this day, or give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day to the fowls of the air, to the wild beasts of the earth, that the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." And so we know the end of the story. David took his sling, threw the stone, hit the giant in the forehead, and he went down dead. In verse 51, David ran, stood on the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and slew him, killed him with his own sword and cut his head off. Isn't that gruesome? We hear of beheadings today, don't we, in the news all the time. And we're sickened, we're nauseated by such an idea. Here, I guess it was commonplace in those days, but here was David engaged in that. It's a gruesome act. Today we refer to somebody who does that as a savage, uncivilized. You hear people saying only animals would do something like this to a human being, and yet David did it. David did, in his defense, what warriors did in those days. David, though, was reacting in a, you might say, a higher way, because he was reacting to the challenge against God's name that Goliath had made. So, okay, here we've seen two examples: David's sin, David dealing being a murderer. Let's revisit this idea of how could David be called by the Lord a man after his own heart. Well, let's go back to Acts again, Acts 13, where we saw Paul speaking. Let's kind of pick this apart here and see exactly what is being said, and see if we can figure out why the Lord was justified in calling him a man after his own heart. Acts 13 again, and in verse 21. "Afterward, they desired a king. God gave unto them Saul the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up unto them David to be their king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, which shall fulfill all my will." You notice when this was said, we often hear, how can David be called a man after God's own heart because of all that he did? Well, that statement was actually made before David was even made king. David was found by the Lord to be a man after his own heart at that point in time. Now, I'm not saying that he wasn't, by the end of his life, still a man after God's own heart, but at this point in time, he had not accumulated all the blood in his hands and all the sins that he was to do. That's when God said, he's a man after my own heart, somebody he was looking for. He actually was hoping that Saul would be like that too, but Saul turned out that he wasn't. He also says here that David, in addition to being a man after my own heart, shall or will fulfill all my will. This is looking into the future. The Lord was prophesying that David would fulfill everything that the Lord wanted him to do. He's not prophesying that David would be full of sin. He's not even implying that David would be sin-free or perfect. He's simply prophesying that by the time David's life ends, he will fulfill all my will. And knowing how God can look into the future, David is also going to fulfill God's will to be here at the resurrection and to become a king again. So the Lord also predicted in various places that David would be an ancestor of himself. We saw that with the genealogies. When the Lord came as Jesus Christ, he was able to look back at his ancestor David. Now, you think to yourself, when Jesus was growing up as a child, and he would hear people talk about genealogies, he probably heard his own family saying, oh, we're descended from David. I wonder how many times little flashes of memory passed through Jesus' mind from the time he was dealing with David as a human being. He obviously had memories. He stated at one time that he remembered seeing Satan falling as lightning from heaven. And he remembered Abraham, before Abraham's day I was. And so was he thinking of David too as he was growing up? And was he thinking of David based not on David's sins and bloody life, but was he thinking of David based on David's repentant life? And that's the key to something here. And this all relates actually to the upcoming Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread season that we're about to do. Yes, David was called by the Lord a man after my own heart. He called him that when he called David to be the king. David, like every last human being who's ever lived, sinned, made mistakes, failed the Lord. But he also, maybe more than most men that you can even think of, was a repentant man. The things that he did, he repented of. And in tears, in ashes, in, you know, heartfelt repentance, and we have Psalm 51, you know, after he had committed adultery with Bathsheba. We have a hymn in our hymn book about that, how he was so repentant. So God looks on the heart, and the statement, he's a man after my own heart, was based on when he first picked out David to be what he wanted. And now that it's all over, God can say, yeah, it's after David's repentances, he is a man after my own heart. He's obviously is, because he's going to resurrect him to be a king in the millennium. So that concludes this first part of the series about David, giving an introduction to David, explaining his the way God looks at him, his history. It's, like I said, the first of a three-part series. Part two will be in 2 weeks. And in that one, I'm going to address some of the good things that David did for the nation of Israel. And with all the bad things you read about what he did, and there were plenty of things that he did bad, I don't want to concentrate on those next time. I just want to talk about some of the great things and the good things that he did for the people and for the nation. And then the last part, part three, will be actually on the last day of Unleavened Bread, April the 10th. And there I'm going to address David's qualifications for becoming the resurrected king over the tribes of Israel under the King of Kings, Jesus Christ.